Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, register restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. I'm glad I'm not doing the first little segment here by myself.
Yeah. Got a little stuck on the North Bay Extension on the way in today, but I made it.
Yeah, sure did. Just barely. You're a little ruffled.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm glad I made it today so that you didn't have to be the restaurant guy. You know, last night I talked to a reporter from New Jersey Monthly Magazine mm-hmm. who interviewed me about a very interesting topic. They wanted to hear our take on downtowns, and I live in Jersey City, on downtowns in New Jersey, on urban centers in New Jersey.
Sure, we both lived in New Brunswick for a long time, you even longer than I. And we've owned a restaurant in a downtown urban area for 15 years.
Well, I mean, that was the hook. I mean, I think what he wanted to talk to, and, you know, I live in Jersey City. I'm from Orange. My dad was the Orange Fire mm-hmm. Chief. I lived in New Brunswick. You lived in New Brunswick. But I think what he really wanted to talk about was our experience owning a business in town as a town changed. I mean, we've had our business in town for 15 years. We've been working in town for 20 years. And it was very interesting. I wound up talking to this guy and realizing just how much it has changed.
Oh, it's changed tremendously. New Brunswick, and I, a lot of our listeners have known New Brunswick for a long time, but some of you are relatively recent to the area. But the tremendous, tremendous strides that New Brunswick has made and changes to the neighborhoods. One of the things I tell my customers all the time, where my restaurant is right now, State Theater is a 3,000-seat event theater. George Street Playhouse, one of the best playhouses in the country,
Company
I think,
theater.
regional playhouses in the country. Crossroads Theater now is operating as a rental
concert venue.
Rental event. If you told me I was going to open a restaurant on this block when I came to college in 1983, I would have laughed in your face.
You said I don't walk there after dark.
Yeah, forget it. I don't. Me and six of my friends don't walk there after dark.
Now you can't afford a condo across the street.
Yeah, and now condos across the street are going for over $1 million.
One of the things that we didn't talk about was that we had seen over time is how restaurants and bars and liquor license establishments affect a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that is very interesting is New Brunswick, like any city, has different neighborhoods that have different character to them. And some local taverns in a residential neighborhood, I think, really can add to a neighborhood. But you've got to watch them very closely, and the owners need to be very responsible.
It depends on what kind of local tavern.
And there,
I mean, you lived on Hartwell Street for a number of years in New Brunswick.
Well, and that was near a local tavern that had become a real college bar hangout. That was actually a place called the Plum Street Pub that was run irresponsibly. It was shut down by the city a couple times, or fined by the city a couple times at the very least. And, you know, they used to dump, 200 drunk people on the street every night at closing time, and it was really disruptive.
At 3 a.m. Okay, right. Remember, closing time in New Brunswick was 3 a.m., so by the time you got everybody out, it's 3:30 a.m.
Now, there are a lot of other local bars who take great pains to try and be a good neighbor. Like, there's another place, a little place called the Ellenwich Pub on a residential corner in New Brunswick. They take great pains because they know that the influx of people into a residential neighborhood, and if there become parking issues, if they become too popular, they can become a victim of their own success because then they can impinge upon the neighbors. But what I always thought was very interesting was in downtown New Brunswick, where years ago pretty much no one lived,
Right, it was just when Francis says no one lived, it was stores and
theaters
shops
and bars
and theaters and bars and restaurants, and there wasn't really a populace that that lived and slept in that area of town.
And one of the ways, and what that needed downtown, mm-hmm. and what the powers that be and the local board of directors realized of the New Brunswick City Market, which is the improvement district downtown, was that just what was maybe not so helpful to have a lot of people clamoring for places to go in the residential neighborhoods where the bar was next to a house and the parking was on the street and maybe blocking someone's driveway, was exactly what was needed downtown. Mm-hmm. And that sort of led to the attitude that fostered the restaurant renaissance in downtown New Brunswick. And, well, what happened? You put people on the streets at night, until late at night, during the day, in the afternoon. You made it a safe place to walk and a safe place to be. And what do you have, $800 million worth of luxury housing that's gone up in downtown New Brunswick?
It's actually a little bit more than that right now.
I mean, plus you've got a brand new conference center that's about to open. And New Brunswick is known as a restaurant mecca. And that includes fine restaurants and brew pubs and bars and taverns and a place to walk around. And that, to me, that speaks to a restaurant being a locus of community. But I think the point is that it depends on the bar and it depends on the neighborhood, but a restaurant and a bar has an impact on a community, and that can be a good impact and that can be a bad impact.
Well, there's actually an article on the front of the Times today in the food section. It doesn't necessarily have to be a restaurant or a bar to have an impact on a community like that. One of the places that they're talking about in the Times today
is a yogurt place in West Hollywood.
It's a yogurt place in West Hollywood, and this place has become so popular that cars are double parking, and sometimes the lines as much as an hour. Cars are double parking for an hour while they stand on line. There's this huge influx of people, and the people who live around it are actually trying to get this yogurt place shut down. It's a yogurt place. Okay, we're no longer talking about a bar. We're no longer talking about 3:30 in the morning.
It's called Pinkberries, right? And you want to know the irony of it? The owners, when they went to open the yogurt place, had originally tried to open a bar. But because the neighbors had such concerns, they didn't get their liquor license.
Right.
And so they changed ideas and opened a yogurt place.
And the yogurt place is more popular probably than the bar ever would have been.
So the city council has now shortened their evening hours, and they're trying to work out a compromise, but they literally have guards outside to control the crowds, and they have staff go and pick up the Pinkberry cups from the neighbor's lawn. I can only wish for such success.
Maybe in the near future.
But, you know, I do think it's interesting because we were talking about Jersey City. We were talking about downtown New Brunswick. Mm. We were talking about different downtowns. And in this day and age, look, there aren't many factory towns anymore. And so
factory cities, really.
Or factory cities. Or factory towns. There aren't places where, you know, at least in New Jersey, where the economy is driven by manufacturing. And what do all the revitalized cities in New Jersey have in common? Restaurants. What is Newark trying desperately to get? Mm-hmm. More restaurants, better restaurants, because it brings people out and provides a center of community.
There have been a number of cities who've contacted us to try and say, listen, do you want to come and open a restaurant in our city? We'll help you do that.
There was actually one city that they brought us in, they showed us around, and they're like, okay, we'll condemn any building you want, put a restaurant in it. And we're like, no,
none of these, not this city.
Call us in a few years. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Marcus Samuelson, a chef and author who you've certainly heard of, and he's going to join us to talk about his new book in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Marcus Samuelson. Marcus is chef and co-owner of Aquavit, New York's premier Scandinavian restaurant, and culinary director of Ringo, an American-Japanese fusion restaurant. He was the youngest chef ever to receive 3 stars from the New York Times, and he was named Best Chef of New York City by the James Beard Foundation in 1999. He joins us today to discuss his new book, The Soul of a New Cuisine, A Discovery of the Foods and Flavors of Africa.
Chef Marcus Samuelson, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. I've actually eaten your food. I was at Ringo. Actually, we met several years ago through Anthony Giglio at your place, Ringo, when we had a tremendous meal.
Thank you.
This new book, The Soul of a New Cuisine, let's start with the title. I mean, Africa is not a new place. It's a very old continent with a lot of different cultures and a lot of ancient cuisine. Why did you call it The Soul of a New Cuisine?
Well, I mean, I think it is not new for people from the continent, but the newness really becomes when we here as American start to use African ingredients, and maybe we pair it with our own favorite dishes that we already have. So maybe you do an African side, maybe you do an African rub and, on your next chicken dish, so therefore it becomes a new meal, you know, new creation. And the other thing that happened that I want to do with the book is also fellow Africans don't look at each other's country and borrow from each other. You know, a German family might cook Italian food 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
Because Germans, you know, they're on vacation in Italy a lot, and so on, right, and trade and so on with Italy. A Moroccan family is not cooking Ethiopian meals 2 days a week. Ethiopian family is not looking to and trying to cook a Nigerian meal 2 days a week. So, you know, it's I'm also talking to fellow Africans about what's going on about food in other fellow African countries.
So the countries are more isolated from one another.
Well, I wouldn't say even
not geographically, but
no, yeah, exactly.
Culinarily.
So much of this has to do with obviously a large middle class, tourism, vacationing. Mm-hmm. How do we know about food? You know, how do we know about Italian food? Yes, through history, but also by going to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we know about French food? By traveling, visiting there. So it's not new at all, but it's a part of the world that we, for whatever reason, haven't acknowledged and brought in the food family the way we have acknowledged and brought in the rest of the world yet. Doesn't mean it won't happen, just it took us a long time to embrace the whole Asian community, and it took a long time to embrace the Latin American community, and it didn't mean that that was new food when Douglas brought it to us, you know?
Well, one of the things you talk about in the book, and I think a lot of people who are in the food business realize, is how differently people in the rest of the world eat from Americans, although a lot of them are getting closer and closer to the way we eat, probably unfortunately, but how really different it is in Africa, and how plate composition in African food is very different than it is here in America. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, you know, I will say that we don't have it figured out here either. You know, I think the way people eat in Africa is very encouraging. You know, people have much less economy, but they eat probably better than we do. They eat organic without thinking about it. They always eat together. You know, there's no grandmother or there's no child eating by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's people eating together all the time. There is when you embrace the totality of cooking, which means starting by buying stuff at the market, maybe even the slaughtering part, maybe even the slow bracing, the long cooking. So it's just not the eating part that is important. It's the whole ritual by eating, where cooking, where eating is one aspect. So you know there is so much we can learn and look at other cultures and learn how can we bring this in home here.
Well, you know, let's tell our listeners, they may not all be familiar with you, Marcus. You were born Ethiopian and then adopted and raised Swedish. Came to New York and opened a Scandinavian and then a Japanese restaurant. You've got quite a breadth of culinary traditions and experience. How did you come to African cuisine yourself?
Well, you know, being born in Ethiopia, I think felt that why isn't there enough knowledge about this cuisine? If I go to Barnes & Noble or any great, not just Barnes & Noble, but any great store, bookstore, and I find 400 titles about Tuscany, which 5,000 people live in Tuscany,
mm-hmm.
and I find 2 titles about the continent of Africa, or if any,
mm-hmm.
you know, the miseducation has to stop somewhere. You know, we have to also give tools for people to enjoy Africa with a different sense than just war, AIDS, and famine, and that Africa needs help all the time.
When we come back, we're going to talk more with Marcus Samuelson about his new and beautiful book about some of the foods of Africa and some foods of Africa that you can find here in the United States. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:24.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The Matagat and Tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're talking today with Marcus Samuelson, author and chef. His new book is The Soul of a New Cuisine, The Discovery of the Foods and Flavors of Africa. You know, Marcus, we had opened in New Brunswick about 10 years ago. A Nigerian friend of ours, a guy we went to college with, opened an Ethiopian restaurant right around the corner from us. Mm-hmm. And it's called Makeda, and it's wonderful. And
really a great place.
And we go there for lunch often when we want to have a meeting
whenever
outside of our own restaurant.
Whenever we need a meeting outside of our own restaurant.
One of the things that I love about Ethiopian cuisine is the injera.
Yeah.
Can you talk about bread and African cuisine in general?
And, well, injera, and the roller place.
And injera specifically?
You know, the staple dishes is probably what changes Africa. It's both different in Africa from country to country. You know, you have couscous in Morocco and something called tap in South Africa, which is like a polenta. And then you have fufu, which is like a mashed root vegetable puree. And in Ethiopia, the staple becomes bread, you know, which is the only country there that has that. But it becomes this teff. It's made with a grain called teff, one of the oldest grains in the world. And it's a sourdough pancake that you sort of just take, if you make it traditionally, 3 days to do this, start a sourdough starter. And then you cook it on one side only. That's how it's, why it's so porous and soft. And it becomes like almost like a thick pancake batter that you just sort of pour out on the skillet, and it's used probably in every meal in Ethiopian food. It's something that you pick up the food, you stews with, and it's very. I mean, Ethiopian food. I think the popularity of it is because one, it's very cheap. You know, you can do it together as a group and don't get killed by it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Then also, I think the flavors are incredible because the spicy Berber spice blend, the injera bread then takes off the heat with the sour. So it's already somebody thought about the cuisine, like, and when something takes off the heat, which so it's very sophisticated, although it might not look like that on the outset.
Well, now, and in Ethiopian cuisine, you use the bread to pick up the food rather than utensil.
It's actually your utensil.
Yes, it is the utensil, exactly.
Well, you know, I think that you know, it's funny, when we go into to Makeda, they'll offer a new people. They'll say, do you want a fork? You know? And I'm sure that I always say, you know, because I dine with my friend Ogbi, who's Nigerian, but I think every time that you and I go and have lunch, I think, you know, we probably look very unsophisticated to Ethiopians who really know how to do this without making a mess. Do we? Is there a technique?
Well, I try to not take too big pieces. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like, you don't rip off too much bread and try to stuff yourself. You know, it's not, you know, if you stay with sort of, you can hold it small, you know, not bigger than a quarter size or golf, ping pong size balls. Pockets at the time, I think you're fine. I still get messy. I'm from Ethiopia. I still get messy.
You've made me feel a lot more secure about myself, Marcus.
Thank you.
Well, when we come back after the news, we're going to talk more with Marcus Samuelson about his book. We're going to link you as to how to buy it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll also put up Makeda Ethiopian Restaurant, where you can go visit locally and try some of what we're talking about. Back in just a few moments, you're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Our guest today is Marcus Samuelson. He is chef and co-owner of Aquavit and culinary director of Restaurant Ringo in New York City. He's also an author and a TV personality. His new book is The Soul of a New Cuisine, A Discovery of the Foods and Flavors of Africa.
You know, Marcus, Francis and I had the good fortune to, on this past Monday night, do a fundraiser for a local family. and able to raise about $40,000 for,
oh, wow, great.
For them to take care of their child, and they have a child who can't eat any food and has a very rare disorder. but you are the U.S. spokesman for UNICEF, pretty big organization, pretty big responsibility. What role / responsibility do you think restaurants and our community has to in these charitable endeavors?
Well, I think it's a hard one, because I think restaurants is one of the communities that does the most for charities, you know. And yet restaurants, if you look at them, they can be big businesses, but most of them are actually small mom-and-pop stores or versions of that. So I think if you look at percentage of what we do versus, you know, corporate America, I think we do a lot.
Yeah.
But I think each restaurant should just look into, I mean, you can't do everything, right? And both, you know, all of us, we get more requests than we possibly can do. So I stick with the ones that, I stick with UNICEF. You know, I was an orphanage myself, you know, and so it's very hard, close to the heart to me, what I see with UNICEF's work in Africa, what they do in all over the world. I also stick with CCAP, which is, you know, teaching inner-city kids about cooking and about our field, and encouraging them that when you grow up, you can be a chef, and this is our field, or you can be a restaurant manager, and it's a craft, and it's a regular job, you know, because I don't think...
CCAP does great stuff. We had Richard Grausman on our show.
Richard, for me, it's an incredible individual.
And you can find out more about CCAP by going to restaurantguysradio.com. But and looking at the show archives for Richard Grausman, Grausman.
Now, so I think it's really up to each team, each individual, each restaurant to say, hey man, we're gonna do two things that we believe in a year, and then we maybe wanna do one or two one-offs that we can also support, or like you guys just stepped up and did this for us, obviously a friend in your community. And you should just look at what you can do yourself. But food is an incredible thing, that through food people can see your passion and your culture, and you can teach people where you're from and what you believe in, which not every business can really do, you
mm-hmm.
know. Some businesses just write a check, you know, and that's mm-hmm. that. You know?
You know what's funny is I also think that, like, it's like you said, restaurant businesses, especially in the East Coast and the West Coast, and especially in the fine dining end, is sort of the last bastion of mom-and-pop business. It's, while there are corporate restaurants, certainly, the best restaurants and even the most cherished casual restaurants in most communities are these local restaurants. And it's that, you know, their own – when a small business is owned by a man or a woman or a couple, you feel more of a responsibility to take part in the community.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
a
absolutely.
It's a person-to-person thing. But talk to us about UNICEF. When I was a kid, when Mark and I were kids going out trick-or-treating on Halloween, we had our little orange UNICEF boxes and collected our dimes and quarters and pooled them all together. And the teacher told us.
When we were kids, it was a lot of pennies.
Yeah, a lot of pennies.
Yeah, but you know, that's an incredible, you know, the whole, you know, Danike and doing all that started. I got involved with UNICEF as a kid the same way in Sweden, you know, so mm-hmm. it's a worldwide thing, and it happens. You know, with UNICEF, I do a lot of different things. I've done everything from cooking classes in Africa, working with farmers in Africa, how can they take care of their soil, how can they grow potatoes all year round and stuff like that. But also showing a lot of young boys how to cook, because a lot of places in Africa, people, men don't know how to cook, and men are not taught, boys are not taught how to cook, so... And it could be something that we're doing here now in New York, March 14th, called the TAP Project, where we really, just for a day, we're going to charge our customers $1 per glass of water, per regular tap water, and it's going to go to UNICEF Fund for finding clear water for a lot of kids, you know?
You know, I think that one of the other reasons that we get involved, that restaurants get involved, and that people are also more inclined to participate in a restaurant fundraiser,
is
that when you're eating, you know, and when we're... nourishing ourselves and realizing, especially in wealthy countries, the great abundance that we have and the many choices that we have, and that our kids are nourished. You know, at that moment, I am probably most likely to reach into my wallet and pull out $10 for somebody. If you ask me at that moment, you know, hey, somebody's hungry somewhere. Can we get a little for them? I think there's a real connection between feeding people and eating, and then feeding people who need some help.
Yeah.
But Marcus, I think you've hit on something great here in that. Each of us should be, you know, find something that's close to your heart. Find something that touches
whatever
you.
Whatever it is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, through cooking, through our field, through taking kids in your community to the local market and showing, you know, what's the difference between organic food and other food, and just eating right could be the smallest thing. It doesn't have to be major stuff, you know, because you guess what? You did change those 5-10 kids' day and insights on food for that afternoon, and probably they're going to go home to their parents and say, hey, man, why are we, you know, what can we get? What can we do, you know?
Well, talk to us then about this careers through culinary arts program where you take at-risk kids and or you're on the board of directors, but the program overall takes thousands of at-risk kids and puts them in a serious culinary program.
Yeah, I felt like with Richard's program, you know, it's not just in New York. He started in New York, but it's not just a New York issue. It's all over America. And Richard's done a great job of putting across America. And, you know, when you're 16, 17, you're at risk for a lot of this, especially inner city kids. And cooking is very much like being in a positive group, in a positive gang, so to speak. You know, you're in a kitchen. You're working with a little bit older guys. It's a high-paced energy. You got to behave. You got to show up on time. And guess what? You got to be a good team player. Otherwise, you can't fit in the kitchen, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's even if they don't stay in the kitchen, it's just a lot of life skills that you can bring with you and take with you to whatever job. And, you know, now 10 years later, we have successful executive chefs. We have restaurant managers. We have executive pastry chefs. So it does show that it was, you know, it was important.
And these are kids who might have gone the wrong way if they didn't, but for this.
I mean, who would? I mean, like, when, you know, you look, I know for myself when I was 16, 17, you know, I had the kitchen at that time, and guys were 21, 22 years old. I was looking up to them, and so I had somewhere to go, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's a toss-up at that time, I think, you know, it really is, you know.
Well, you know, and you talk about structure, because in a kitchen, and this is, you know, no pun intended, but if you don't follow the rules and the regulations in a kitchen, you literally get burned. You literally,
you
know, turn to the wrong way or don't follow the policies, you're going to get hurt.
I also think that you do a very valuable thing because, you know, there were the vocational and technical schools, which there still are, and they still do a great service, but those jobs are very at risk these days, and it's not like there are the local art, you know, as many local artisanal stable manufacturing jobs in the economy for people who may not choose to go to a four-year college, which is not to say that some chefs don't go to a four-year college, but, you know, cooking is now a tremendous profession and a cornerstone of this economy.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And I just think you learn a lot. I mean, I've traveled all over the world through food, and even if you don't have those opportunities, you can just go, you know, if you're an American kid and you work in a Japanese restaurant, guess what? You just learned about Japanese culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Next year you work in an Italian restaurant, you learn something there. So your restaurant also gives you, or your Mexican restaurant, so it gives you this allowance to learn about other cultures. So you probably wouldn't have if you just work in another environment.
Well,
a
tremendous way to learn about African culture and African cuisine in a way that you unless you've been there, you couldn't possibly understand it is in Marcus Samuelson's beautiful book, The Soul of a New Cuisine, A Discovery of the Foods and Flavors of Africa. And when we come back, Marcus, I want to talk with you about the food that you're cooking in your restaurants in New York and what's going on in New York these days.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We'll be back in just a moment with Marcus Samuelson, chef and owner of Aquavit and Ringo. You're listening to The Restaurant Guy. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on Nine is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on Nine supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on Nine has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on Nine, the service is exemplary, expert and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightsonnine.com. That's lightsonthenumber9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're talking today with Marcus Samuelson, chef and co-owner of Aquavit and culinary director of Ringo Restaurant in New York City. Marcus, you were born in Ethiopia, you were raised in Sweden, you came to New York, you were awarded 3 stars at Aquavit, the Scandinavian restaurant in New York City. Ringo is great, it's an American-Japanese fusion restaurant. When's the African restaurant going to open?
I hey, man, I'm trying. I'm trying to open it so bad. I would love to. You know how it is to open a restaurant. You need a lot of, you know, a lot of money, and you need the right location. And if you have the right money, the location comes easier, right? No, but it's a hard thing. I definitely want to do it one day. I feel definitely, you know, writing the book was sort of the, I felt that was the right way to start it, because I wanted people to be aware that there is a Pan-African cooking possibility and so on. Mm-hmm. And I also felt that there's a, when you have a restaurant, you give people one experience. But when you have a book experience and people go home and cook it at home, you sort of, you bond in a different way, you know? Mm-hmm. And restaurant might be one way to do it, but this book form is also another way to do it, to communicate with people about a cuisine that they might not be familiar with. And it's sort of like, I just want to invite people in and be encouraged about this cuisine, because you know, the foods of Africa really comes from many places. It comes from India, Indonesia, Malaysia, and then it was, you know, was traded or all came through trading, came to Africa very often. And then you have, obviously, the colonization that had a lot of impact on African food, the Portuguese, the French, and so on. And then you have the African giving influences to Sardinia, Sicily, and Spain, and also Brazil, you know, and the Caribbean islands. And when you think about that, through trading, it came to the southern states of America. You know, there's a reason why we have okra and rice in mm-hmm. South Carolina and North mm-hmm. Carolina. So when you look at it from that aspect, you know, it's essentially 2 billion people that it has affected, you know, that has impacted of this. Yeah. And when you are in Senegal, you see the same food in Brazil, in Bahia. When you are in Malaysia and you taste the foods in Durban, it's the same flavors. And it's, you know, I've been lucky enough to have been to all these places, so I've been eating in markets and people's homes, but not most people have. So this is really my letter to them saying, hey, man, there's a link here, and guess what? You can be the benefiter and go home and cook this and, you know, talk to your kids about that.
You know, we had Floyd Cardos on the show, the chef at Tabla recently, talking about some of the Indian spices.
Yep.
What are some of the spices that are integral to this cuisine?
Cuisines? They're so different, but, you know, it's very similar to the Indian. You know, you go to an island like Zanzibar, where the Arabs and the Persians and the Indians and the Africans always met through trading of spices, or Marrakesh, right, to the capital of trading. But, you know, in Zanzibar, you have fresh turmeric, you have vanilla, you have cloves, you have cardamom. So essentially, what would make curries, right, a different version of curries. In you go to Northern Africa, it's a little more floral. You know, you have a spice blend that you find even all the way to Iran, satar, that is a citrusy, more floral note. You have in Morocco, you have a main spice blend called El Rasanout, which is cumin, cardamom, cinnamon, a little bit of milder chilies. So then you go to Tunisia, and you have harissa, which has a little bit more red chilies, so Serrano chilies can be a wet paste. Then you come to a place like Senegal, where you have the Scotch bonnet a lot, the stronger chilies.
Now,
Scotch bonnet is one of the spiciest chilies in the world.
So there is a complete, I mean, the Arab food in general, the Arab Africa, is not spicy food. It's very floral and it's very flavorful, but it's not spicy. You know, the Portuguese was the one who brought chilies to Africa. And in Mozambique, Angola, and in Brazil, you find something called piri-piri. And that spice blend is really chilies, red chilies, Thai chilies, red chilies, with garlic, lemon juice, olive oil, parsley, and cilantro. That's used for everything.
Now, do you think that with your book that your adventurous cook at home can work these spices into their cooking?
Absolutely. I mean, these are flavors and foods that we're already doing without knowing it. You know, like these are stews. Actually, it's easier to do this book than most books because it's family food. It's not restaurant food that we sort of dumbing down for you to cook. Right,
right, and it's not a la minute necessarily.
No,
it's things
stews.
You can.
So I did oxtail soup yesterday, oxtail stew yesterday, and these are all regular food. It's a vocabulary that we have to get used to, right? Before we knew the difference between sushi, sashimi, tiraditos, and so on, or ceviches, we were just lost in all of these words, right?
Right.
But once we knew, there's a major difference between ceviche and sushi, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nobody thinks it's different. Nobody thinks it's a weird thing to order. It's a matter of mood. So I want this book to sort of open up that new vocabulary.
Yeah, you may need to go to the market and pick up some new spices and some new ingredients.
Yeah, and then you can like, wow, garam masala is actually this. Al Ras Hanout gives me this flavor. Harissa gives me this.
Well, let me ask you a question. Now, you've opened a couple of different restaurants, and now you have a book introducing African cuisine. And your first restaurant was introducing, I mean, Scandinavian cuisine wasn't exactly a staple, nor is it today a staple of the New York City restaurant scene.
Is.
What are the similarities between, I mean, you introduced Americans to an unfamiliar cuisine at Aquavit, and you're introducing them to an unfamiliar cuisine here with African food. Are there similarities with how you bring a new cuisine to people, to Americans?
I think this is common, but I'm curious, my curiosity, and if you do something well, Americans are always open to try it. You know, Americans get a lot of shit for a lot of different things. But you know what? Americans are pretty damn open to try different foods and don't really hold grudges. I'm talking the average Joe, right? If it's good, he'd be there. He'd try it. He'd try it once. If it's not good, he's not coming back.
Right.
But I think he's pretty open. I would say Americans in general are more open trying food than Europeans, you know.
Well, I think it's because we don't have as strong a tradition ourselves, and I think that sometimes bites us a little bit when we're more prone to fall for the processed gimmick.
Yeah.
But it also leaves us more open.
You know, also gives you that, hey, man, I don't care. I'll go down there, give it a try.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's,
absolutely.
It's an open-mindedness that I think as a chef that I've embraced, and people have opened the doors from. They allow me to try different things. You know, I'm not Japanese either, and we have Japanese restaurants. So, you know, it's, I think people, if you serve great Pan-African food and people are, you did well, people will come.
Well, Marcus, you certainly have done well in your restaurants. I've eaten there, and I love them, and I hope that someday you'll come down to New Brunswick and dine with us.
I will.
So much, Marcus.
Thank you very much, guys. Thanks for having me on.
It's been great to have you. Marcus Samuelson is an amazing chef. You can try his food in New York. We'll link you to them through our websites. The book is called The Soul of a New Cuisine, The Discovery of the Foods and Flavors of Africa. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. We're talking with Marcus Samuelson. You really should try his restaurants. If you want to try a broad range of cuisines, you can go for the Scandinavian Aquavit, 3 stars in the New York Times. We'll put a link up to our website. Or Ringo is the Japanese fusion restaurant, a little more hip downtown place. But the book is beautiful, you know.
It also gives a description of a lot of the spices and herbs that are available for this cuisine and that they've been using over time for this cuisine. And, you know, there are things that may not be as familiar to us as others. You know, I was going through the book, and I saw one of the ingredients that Marcus likes to use in some of these cuisines is an ingredient called fenugreek. Well, fenugreek, for those of you who don't know, is a supplement that's frequently given to breastfeeding mothers when they're just starting breastfeeding. Well, it helps produce milk for the baby.
Yeah.
So a lot of herbalists will tell you to eat fenugreek.
Yeah.
Something that we learned that when you eat fenugreek.
Oh, God, where's this going?
Oh, it's nowhere bad.
Okay.
Nowhere bad. When you eat fenugreek, you begin to smell a little bit like maple syrup. So some of these things have.
So when you said your wife was sweet, you meant
that. Some of these things have peculiar side effects. I'm like, that smells like obsession with a little side of pancakes. Well, what's up with that?
Marcus having bacon with his wife.
I always wanted breakfast every time I saw my wife for that period of time.
I have to say, you know, it's funny that you did mention with our interview with Marcus, the Floyd Cardos interview in his book, which talks about Indian cuisine. Amazing. But this book was a real revelation to me. I have seen pictures and I have read something about Asia, Indian cuisine. This book is a huge coffee table book, and it's beautiful.
There are
pictures, and I find it very helpful when there's a cookbook or a book about a cuisine where it shows a picture of the place and a picture of the food, because just describing it to me, I don't know if I got it right or if I got it wrong.
Wait, and you get an understanding of the place and the people, and you know, Marcus said something that really touched home. in a lot, most of these communities in Africa, a grandmother doesn't have a meal alone.
And
a child doesn't have a meal alone. You eat as a family.
Well, Mark and I are going to go eat together at Makeda Ethiopian Restaurant in downtown New Brunswick, one of our favorites. You can find that on our website as well. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.